It is 2:06 on a Monday afternoon. That's right, Monday. We are now, as of today, January 9th, on the air 3 days a week here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Political Rewind will be coming to you 2 o'clock on Monday and Wednesday, 3 o'clock on Fridays. And if you cannot listen to us when we're on the air, you can subscribe to our podcast. Just go to Political Rewind at iTunes or your favorite podcast provider and listen to us whenever you want to. I'm a little out of breath. I just ran back into the studio. So I'm going to catch my breath and introduce a former Democratic congressman, Buddy Darden. Buddy, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be back.
Happy New Year. Haven't seen you since the end of last year. Lori Geary, so nice to have you back, the former political reporter for WSB-TV, now launching her own business in the new year. Thanks for coming, Lori.
Thank you. Happy New Year. Great to be here.
Republican strategist Todd Rehm, also the editor of
Pundit.com.
Sorry, Todd, which you can get every day online. Todd's always got a wealth of information. And joining us once again from afar, from the far reaches of Cobb County, where he remains snowed in, AJC political writer Jim Galloway. Hey, Jim.
If there is a Cobb County sand truck within the sound of my voice, please send help.
How much snow do you have up there?
No snow. We just have ice, and it's a very strange. We're in the shadow of Kennesaw Mountain, so we have very steep grades that run north and south, and don't get a whole lot of sun.
All right. Well, Jim, we're glad you could be with us by telephone. Ask your wife to bring you a hot chocolate, and we'll talk.
And highs in the 60s on Thursday.
Yeah, there you go. Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Look, let's start with the legislature because the session began 10 o'clock this morning. Jim, to kick this off, you all published, I thought, a really fascinating poll of how Georgians, voters, are feeling about the issues that matter to them. You published that most of it yesterday in the paper. Let's talk. What do you think the key findings were?
I think that the key findings I found the most interesting part were on social issues, a pair of them, the religious liberty and let me see, the mimosa mandate, the ability to sell alcohol before noon on Sunday, and casino gambling.
Now, well,
the
right.
first one, if you take the first one, okay, you know, overall, I think it's 44% of voters that we polled oppose another fight over religious liberty, a fourth fight, if you will. We had a third one last year, and they passed the bill only to be vetoed by the governor. Only 40% support it. Now, that's not the number that your Republican lawmakers will be looking at. If you look at it, 54% of Republicans support another fight over religious liberty, which isn't all that big a margin. But 54% of independents who often vote the GOP oppose it. That's where the concern is. So you have both. You have David Ralston, Casey Cagle, and the governor all saying, "Let's let Congress take a crack at it this year."
Yeah, well, we knew that, as David Ralston said when he came in to do the show with you and me a while back, Jim. He has no interest in getting embroiled in religious liberty again, and he too agrees that it should be Congress. Todd,
I thought that I think that the one thing that polling doesn't ever convey is intensity, and the difference is that it may be a smaller percentage than in the past who are out there talking about campus carry or about religious liberty, but if you are within the group of folks who go around to Republican Party events or Tea Party events or conservative events, they are still the supporters of those bills are still very vocal. They're very angry. They're very outspoken, and that hasn't waned at all. And so, if you are the type of politician who goes out into public and meets your voters, whether it's 54% or 64%, you won't you may not notice a difference. It's the intensity of the voters who that's the one thing they care about and they want to bend your ear about.
But the real poll that matters that was not referred to in the paper yesterday was the North Carolina poll, in which the governor lost re-election primarily because of legislation like this. And they elected a Democratic governor while voting for Donald Trump for president and to re-elect the United States Senator from that area. So I think that is looming in the back of legislators, too. I served two terms down there, not as long as many of them. But I am a little bit familiar with the mindset, and we notice polls.
I think, you know, this issue has gotten so much attention the past really 2-3 years. We saw what happened in Indiana. We saw what happened in North Carolina. And I think the poll reflects that voters are just sick of it. I mean, and they know that nothing will get done when Governor Nathan Deal is in office. He vetoed it once, that legislators are not going to try their hand at it again, and that it's just probably time to move on.
But Jim, Todd's point is interesting and important. You go out as a member of the legislature and see those groups that are the most invested in what happens down there. And he's right, isn't he, that it's likely those are folks who are going to say...
Oh, absolutely. Look, Georgia continues to be governed, as we've said many, many times, through the prism of a Republican primary. It's about who shows up at a Republican primary. And Todd's exactly right. Those intense voters are the ones who show up. I still find it just absolutely amazing that GOP voters are split 47-48% on casino gambling, and 47-52% on the mimosa bill. I mean, that just boggles. I mean, back when you and I had started covering politics, those were just impossible figures.
Yeah, that's exactly
regardless,
right.
Regardless of intensity.
Yeah.
What I was more interested in, Jim, is one of your colleagues wrote, I just saw it this afternoon, a little squib about the difference in economic outlook between folks who are in North Georgia, Metro Atlanta, and South Georgia, where Metro Atlantans, which was really by and large Hillary land, feel much more optimistic about the economy than folks, particularly in Southeast and Southwest Georgia, which went Trump. And I think that the increasing split between rural and especially rural South Georgia and the rest of the sort of suburban donut Republicans is going to be interesting to keep an eye on.
No, absolutely. And Bill, I would say, you weren't at the at last week's press conference with House Speaker David Ralston, but one of the things that he was most passionate about during his meeting with reporters was the extension of internet availability to rural Georgia. And he says, you know, that the ability to tap into the internet is equal to transportation and everything else, and everything else that makes an economic engine out of the community.
That all said, Lori, I do think you can make a case for your feeling that people are tired of this. This is a Senate-House split. It has been going on 4 years now. The Senate rushes in and passes a religious liberty bill early in the session, and then it sits in the House because David Ralston has no interest, maybe even less interest this year because of what Buddy's pointing out, what happened up in North Carolina.
Right.
It's interesting that it's the people's House, if you want to use that expression, where they've stopped this thing.
Time and time again. But on the flip side, the House has passed campus carry. And that has sat in the Senate. So, you know, there's a dichotomy here, and there are different issues here that come out of the gate first. But I think the poll also shows that the voters are kind of tired of campus carry as well. It's one of the main issues that we've covered for the past 4 years, 5 years, dating back. But you're right. When Republicans are in control, when Democrats are in control, there's still egos involved. So you still have, you know, Republicans in the Senate want this, then Republicans in the House want this. Sometimes I thought we got a lot more done when Democrats controlled the Senate, the House controlled, or was it controlled by Republicans?
Well, I know this will come as a great shock to the people around the table here, but lots of times legislators want credit for voting for something that they hope never will pass. And I think there might be a little of that involved here in that the Senate can vote for religious freedom, saying that, sure, I voted for it, and go back home and say I did. Too bad that House killed it. And then the House people can say, well, I voted for campus carry. But unfortunately, those people on the Senate did it. So I know this comes as a great shock to you, but those things do happen, and that is some of the mindset involved in these legislators.
Jim, let's look at campus carry. We've mentioned it several times. Your poll says 54% of the people you surveyed do not want it introduced again. You have any added information about that in terms of cross tabs?
I'm trying to find out very, very quickly to find out what the Republican.
Yeah.
I think the Republican vote on that. I'm going to take a while. Guess here. I think it was about 60%, maybe higher.
Saying they want campus carry to be reintroduced.
Mm-hmm. Sure. 65% of Republicans backed campus carry, and 55% of independents voted against it. That's another one of these Republican independent splits. Sometimes I find that more telling about where the real roadblocks are than looking at the Democratic vote, because you can pretty much predict the Democratic vote. But the independents, the swing votes, they prefer to vote conservative, as we've seen in election after election. And if you've got 55% of independents against it, that means something.
Todd, do you think there's any question that campus carry will once again make it to the floor of the House this year?
I think it'll make it to the floor of the House. I think that there is a good chance it will be a somewhat less strong version than in the past. And one of the great things, Buddy was talking about this a little bit earlier, I think one of the great parts of our constitutional system here in Georgia and federally is that it is designed to make it difficult to pass bills when it becomes really tough. And so I don't think we're going to have a final bill come out of both houses and sent to Governor Deal's desk. But I think that there will be enough folks interested in having the conversation, some because they believe it and some for the benefit of their constituents at home, that there will be bills passed.
Lori, you were down there last session when they passed campus carry, and after the fact, after they'd voted, Governor Deal weighed in for the first time and said, well, there are certain things I wish you'd go back and adjust. I'm not satisfied with this bill as it is now, and I'm not sure I want to sign it the way it is now. Change these provisions. And, of course, the House dug in its heels and said no. I personally am still puzzled by the way in which the governor approached that. But eventually he did veto it. The question is, and I don't know that any of us can answer this, is whether the governor has been having conversations with the speaker and other leaders in the House about what might be an acceptable campus carry bill for him. Is it the provisions that he said he wanted last time?
Well, I know the governor had some concerns about the daycares that are located on college campuses and that he wanted that included in the exceptions. And what we found out, though, when we were reporting is that most of the daycare centers are located in dormitories, so that those were already exempt in the law. But the governor had made it clear, but I thought you bring up an interesting point, because if you heard about David Ralston's speech today when he was elected Speaker of the House once again, he really emphasized the division, the separation of powers, that the House is a separate entity. I think he was signaling to Governor Deal that we will rule the way we rule here and that there is a clear separation.
You know, it's easier, Jim, for the speaker to say that to a governor who truly is moving into the lame duck phase of his tenure as governor of the state.
Oh, absolutely. But I thought the same thing. I thought that, and to your point, Bill, your earlier point, I think that Ralston's remarks were a sign that really some conversations have not yet begun. I think that was an opening argument there. I think there's a lot of negotiating to be done.
On
campus carry.
Buddy, you're up there in Cobb County, where I suspect that, expanding gun carry privileges is a pretty popular issue, yes?
Not particularly. We have, of course, Kennesaw State University, and we kind of believe that the people who run the university ought to make those decisions. And incidentally, I might remind you that the governor does appoint the Board of Regents and has a lot of input into who the chancellor of the university system is. So I don't think it's particularly popular up there. It might be popular on the crowd that goes to breakfast for the Republicans every other Saturday or so, but It's not really discussed all that much. I guess people would say they are for it, but again, this is not a bread and butter issue. I think it's more of a symbolic issue than anything else.
And I also think that there is not often as much recognition of the fact that statewide legislation is a dull tool to get things done. I went to a law school where guns were regularly on campus. They were allowed, but it was because going out and shooting skeet after class was something that might actually happen. And what might be appropriate for someplace like a Berry College, where you've got tens of thousands of acres, or a University of North Georgia, where you've got a ROTC program, is vastly different from what's appropriate at Georgia State or a Georgia Tech. And state law doesn't allow for those finer distinctions.
Okay. Be interesting to watch how that develops. Here's one that really surprised me. And, Jim, maybe you have a lower or a higher threshold for a surprise than I. 75% of the people you surveyed support expanding Medicaid, and that includes 57% of Republicans, for goodness sake.
And I got to wonder if some of that is buyer's remorse. That kind of struck me, too. I mean, that people are now just getting educated that with Trump coming into the White House in two Fridays, that Obamacare goes out the door. And it's just a matter of how fast it walks out that door. And suddenly you've got millions of people thinking, I might be in a tad of trouble here.
I've got friends who voted for Trump who are on Obamacare, and I've never been able to quite reconcile those two, except that I believe most people on Obamacare who voted for Trump, and it's been estimated to be some 5 million countrywide, really don't think that their health care is going to be taken away. They think it'll be substituted with something else.
Well, I think also, remember during the presidential election, I can remember John Kasich specifically talking about this issue and saying, I expanded Medicaid because those were federal dollars that were coming from Ohio, going to Washington, and we wanted them back for our folks in Ohio. And he really emphasized mental health. That was the big issue where a lot of the money went in terms of Medicaid expansion. So I think there is a message here that, you know, are we missing out if we didn't expand Medicaid under Obamacare?
You know,
it appears that, I mean, judging from the statements from Casey Cagle and Ralston late last week, that they are willing to, we know that the transition to away from Obamacare won't come until after the midterm elections. But it appears from their remarks that they're going to be willing to leave those federal dollars on the table through that period.
Well, I'm still hearing questions among Republicans up on the Hill about what they're going to do, whether they're going to kill Obamacare and then do what you're suggesting, Jim, take a couple of years to put together a new plan, or is it repeal and immediately put I mean, it seems to me there's still a debate going on in Washington over that, no?
I think you're going to see some very intense pressure from the industry, from the healthcare industry, to bring certainty to that transfer. You can't have insurance companies and hospitals and healthcare and other healthcare institutions just kind of winging it for 3 years on a hope and a prayer.
Todd, whether or not it's Obamacare, and we do know that Republicans were thinking this might be the year to actually take advantage of Obamacare to expand Medicaid here, particularly in the way in which, because of the concerns that it would help failing rural hospitals. Stacey Abrams says she's going to fight to expand Medicaid one way or the other. This is an issue that, even if it's led by the Democrats, we're going to see come up downtown this session, yes?
I think we're absolutely going to see it come up. And the way I would start looking at this issue is, how do you define Obamacare? And for most Republicans and for a lot of folks on the inside, on the middle of the political spectrum, Obamacare is whatever they don't like about the current healthcare system, and in the way that for many years, welfare was what somebody else got and what your family got, whether it was Social Security, whether it was Medicare, Medicaid, payments to farmers had been earned and you had paid into the system. And so what I think we'll see is the possibility of a de facto expansion of Medicaid without the state of Georgia having to apply for a waiver. If we go to something along the lines of a block grant, which is what Tom Price has consistently held up as the best way to do it, that means that states get to set their own eligibility rules, their own repayment terms for providers, and that accomplishes a lot of what Republicans in Georgia wanted with respect to Medicare and Medicaid without having to ask the federal government for permission. And they get to say, we expanded health care, which everybody in Georgia wants, without Obamacare, which is whatever we say we don't like.
Well, like it or not now, though, the Republicans own health care. It had been owned by the Democrats up until this last election. But now they asked for it and they got it. And Tom Price, of course, is going to be a key player in the process. But at the same time, not even Tom Price just wants to pull the plug on everything because, like I said before, Republicans own health care and they're responsible for it now.
When we talked to Congressman Tom Price before it was announced that he got the nomination for HHS Secretary, he told us this is going to be complicated and it won't happen overnight. And there are some things that they will definitely have to take a look at, which is the pre-existing conditions that are very popular, and also healthcare eligibility until the age of 26 if you're, you know, living with your parents. I mean, that was also very popular. So there are things that have to be at least on the table for Republicans in terms of a full repeal or a full replace.
So let's finish up. We're going to take a break in a minute. But let's, if I can, I was struck by a couple of other findings in the AJC poll. And again, it relates to some of the issues we're likely to be paying attention to throughout the session. I think it's interesting, Jim. 61% say they support expanding school choice. 69% remain supportive, even if it means giving public tax dollars to private schools. I suspect that's one where the breakdown of Republicans and Democrats is particularly important, because I would think, at least in a generic way, you'd assume Republicans are more interested in getting public dollars for private schools than Democrats are.
Yeah, I'm having trouble bringing up the crosstab on that particular one.
Well, that's because you're up there in the frozen north.
But if I recall correctly, it's not so much Republican, so it is there's some very strong African American support for school choice. That's bumping up that number. Now, does it get complicated when you talk about exchanging swapping out public funding so that a kid can escape a failing school? Yeah, it gets complicated there. But I think that's where you're seeing a lot of that support come from. It's a biracial coalition there.
All right, a couple other quick things, then we'll take a break. Number one, it is interesting, I think, that Barack Obama's approval ratings in Georgia are a little bit higher than Donald Trump. Obama's at like 50%. I think Trump is around 45. Nevertheless, Jim, Trump's numbers are up considerably from the last time you polled the question.
Oh yeah, he's enjoying. It may be a rough honeymoon, but he's enjoying something of a honeymoon. Just for the record, the Georgia legislature has the same approval rating as Barack Obama, which I thought was very interesting. Deal comes in at about 52%, which is just it's slightly higher, but still within the margin of error.
All right, let's take a break and come back. We got a lot more to talk about, a little bit more on state politics, and then moving on to the Trump transition. This is a fascinating week for the Trump transition team, and we'll talk about that. It is 2:30 on Monday afternoon. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Bridges. His performance in the Western Hell or High Water has been nominated for a Golden Globe. We'll talk about Bridges' life and films, his Oscar-winning performance in the 2009 film Crazy Heart, and his cult favorite character, the Dude, from The Big Lebowski. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. With us today, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays in the paper. Jim, are you working on a column? Well, no, it's only Monday.
Well, it's Monday, but you still got to scout some topics out.
Oh, all right.
You've got a transition. One of the most important transition of my lifetime probably happening at the White House these next 10 days. So that's something I'm kind of toying with.
Boy,
yeah,
I got that. Also with us, Jim's stuck up in North Cobb County because of the ice and the bad weather up that way. He can't get out of his driveway. Lori Geary, former political reporter for WSB-TV, is with us. At what point can we stop identifying you that way? I went through that same
you did,
question.
Didn't you?
I mean, we'll just talk about you as a political analyst.
Okay, that sounds good. That's still
fair?
My role at WSB-TV.
That's right. You're
yes.
still doing, you're still got a contract to work with them. Good. I'm glad you mentioned that. Buddy Darden, former Democratic congressman from Cobb County, is with us. Buddy, when do we stop referring? You'll always be the former congressman from Georgia's 7th Congressional District.
Just call me Citizen Darden.
Yeah.
I kind of think of him as an ex-DA.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. And Todd Rehm, Republican consultant, but also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com. Todd, how long in advance are you? Do you already have a pretty clear notion of what's going to be in the first positions for GeorgiaPundit.com tomorrow?
No. What happens is, over the course of the day, I get 3 minutes here, 5 minutes there. I'm looking down at my iPhone, and I email myself the headlines that catch my eye. And then the next morning, starting between 4 and 5, that's when I start looking in earnest. And in the best of worlds, some kind of a theme emerges. Sometimes it's just a potpourri of factoids here and there.
Okay.
Who does your historical part?
Yeah.
Excellent.
So I started that. I occasionally threw a tidbit in, and it was my wife, who is called Mrs. Georgia Pundit, who suggested that I do that every day. There are three main sources I go by. One is the Georgia History Today, and then there's another This Day in Georgia History. One of them, I think, is associated with GPB. I check those always, and I do history.com and historyorb.com. And again, I'm looking for facts that are related to or illuminate Georgia politics today, or some kind of a theme. Sometimes you'll see Georgia struggling with the same issue over the course of 350 years on the same day.
Interesting. Well, Lisa Clark, our Political Rewind producer, has found a great anniversary that we'll get to at the end of the show. And we'll see. I don't remember whether you had this on Georgia Pundit today or not, but we'll get to that a little bit later. By the way, we're on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. So if you want to join the conversation, that's a great way to do that. I never put that out enough. PoliticsGPB. And one other quick note. Lawmakers starts again tonight at 7 o'clock on Georgia Public Broadcasting, the statewide public network. And for those of you who listen to WSB AM 750 in the morning and hear the voice of Scott Slade, the morning drive host, Scott is back in place as the anchor for lawmakers. He has very graciously agreed to come in to give me the opportunity to add an additional day to Political Rewind. So they're on the air every night that the legislature is in session, and they'll be on the air Monday through Thursday of this week. Jim Galloway, if you can get out of his driveway, will be there tonight.
Yeah, if it doesn't freeze.
Yeah. All right. Todd, when I sent out a note about some of the things I wanted to talk about today, you pointed out to me that on Wednesday, the governor will give his state of the state, and the budget will basically, is he going to now do the budget the same day? Is that the way it's been working these days down there? I don't remember.
There's going to be a budget briefing. I just got the emails from the governor's press office maybe an hour ago.
Okay.
He's going to do the state of the state, and then later in the afternoon, his staff will do a budget briefing.
The state of the state, again, will be live on Georgia Public Broadcasting TV, and I think we're carrying it on the radio as well. It's at 11 o'clock, I said. Todd, you say he's going to propose the largest budget in state history.
That's almost certainly the case. The last couple years, as we've lifted out of the recession, Every year you have more money, and one of the things that I credit Governor Deal with doing is continuing to sock away money into the rainy day fund. But there are, you will never find anybody in politics who says there's enough money to go around all the programs, and we're on that upswing, so it'll be, what, somewhere north of $23 billion, I think
was it $21-plus billion in the last, this current fiscal year? Am I right
that
about that?
That sounds right, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's
Jim,
doubled by the fact that you've got the federal part.
Right, that's just the state portion.
Right.
Yeah, it'll be up to the governor to set that ceiling on that number. But Todd's right. I mean, you don't... Unless you've been around politics for 30 or 40 years, you don't understand how big a hole one governor traditionally places his successor in. I mean, it is sometimes unconscionable. Sometimes it can't be avoided. Sometimes it's a fact of economic downturns. But there are I've seen time and time again, and I'm trying to think of when was the worst one. Maybe was it Joe Frank to Zell Miller? Maybe.
Yeah.
Where it was the incoming governor was just placed in a huge hole. I know it happened. It happened with Sonny Perdue when he came in. A lot of that was economic downturn.
So what do we as residents, as voters, do we make anything of the size of the budget here? Do we just say, okay, and shrug it off, or does it matter?
I think it matters if it comes to your individual issue. We saw that with the state troopers and the state patrol and getting pay raises of 20% this year. It also matters when it comes to education. I think that's when the budget really matters because it hits home for so many people. So, you know, the teachers and their pay raises, classroom sizes, all of this is so dependent on the education funding.
We still haven't recovered from the austerity cuts from the Perdue administration when we had the economic downturn. And I hope the governor is continuing to try to make progress in bringing those cuts back to the level, but we aren't there yet.
And then you have new problems that come up for the state that are simply expensive. I think the opioid issue across the state in terms of addiction, in terms of emergency room visits by otherwise healthy people, and in terms of long-term care for children whose parents aren't able to keep them, that's going to be a large driver for the budget for the foreseeable future because there's no cheap antidote to that. There's no cheap answer for that.
Yeah.
Right, and connected to that is the collapse of rural health healthcare in rural Georgia. And that is just going to get absolutely expensive.
And the fact that the economy in parts of rural Georgia is the comeback is lagging behind Metro Atlanta.
All right, we'll have more on the budget. I hope on Wednesday's show. I hope we've seen from the governor's staff by the time we're on the air at 2 some of the details of that budget and can talk about it on the show on Wednesday. If not, we'll certainly do it on Friday's show. Let's move on to this big, big week for the Trump transition team. Starting tomorrow, we're going to see coming at us like a freight train, 7-8 confirmation hearings. Not all of them are cabinet positions, but most of them are. The Trump team has scheduled them packed them right on top of one another. Democrats are crying foul. And Mitch McConnell on Face the Nation yesterday suggested that Democrats should get a life.
What this is about, John, that Democrats are really frustrated that they lost the election. I was in Senator Schumer's position 8 years ago. I know how it feels when you're coming into a new situation that the other guys won the election. What did we do? We confirmed 7 cabinet appointments the day President Obama was sworn in. We didn't like most of them either, but he won the election. So all of these little procedural complaints are related to their frustration at having not only lost the White House, but having lost the Senate. I understand that, but we need to sort of grow up here and get past that. We need to have the president's national security team in place on day one.
So, Jim, this is an easy issue for Democrats to feel upset about. But as McConnell points out, it's not the first time that we've seen confirmation hearings stacked and the Democrats have done basically the same thing.
I think but it's not just confirmation hearings. We're talking about Donald Trump. I think he's got his first press conference since July scheduled.
Wednesday.
On top of that, and a vote on top of that on defunding repealing Obamacare, which will be a very very showy vote in Congress.
So, what are you suggesting, that this is designed to make it difficult for all of us who cover the administration?
Of course it is. It's designed to make sure that no one controversial decision gets too much attention. I will tell you what, though. I mean, you've already got. If I had to pick two to focus on, it would be Jeff Sessions and Rex Tillerson.
Yeah, I was gonna, buddy. That I think Jim is really right on point. Don't you? Sessions hearings start tomorrow. He's in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Tomorrow, I think they've got 2 days set aside for him. And Tillerson starts tomorrow as well. Sessions, of course, is under particular scrutiny because his past as Attorney General of the state of Alabama includes what some people think was discriminatory behavior.
True, but Sessions is a member of the club. He's one of the boys. He's a member of the United States Senate, which has been called upon to confirm him. So I think it's highly unlikely that he will be turned down for confirmation. I will say this. They'll bruise him up a little bit and make him a little humble. But at the same time, the idea of the United States Senate not confirming one of its own, a sitting member, I think is just unheard of. John Powell might have been an exception of that, but he was already out of the Senate by that time.
But I'll tell you what, there's some excellent theater brewing on this. Democrats are trying to get Republican permission to let John Lewis testify during those confirmation hearings. And both Sessions and Lewis came kind of from the same area of Alabama, and they're roughly of the same age. So you would have very, very distinct historic versions of what the South was like over that period. It would be absolutely fascinating to watch both men.
As you say, great theater, but at the same time, it boils down to the fact that will you have the votes to confirm Jeff Sessions, and I predict that he'll be confirmed.
Well, the reality is, Todd, that the Republicans, largely based on a procedure that the Democrats put in place when they controlled the Senate, can confirm any of the nominees because all they require now is a simple majority to do it. So the most the Democrats can do is try to raise some dark clouds around the nominees.
And to drag it out and make it as embarrassing as possible and get as much stink spread on the nominees as possible. You know, I don't think any of the nominees so far are going to drop out. We haven't heard the kind of accusations that leads to that. But they're going to make it painful. They're going to exact some measure of feeling better for themselves about it.
But it looks like they're going to be moving these nominations before they've been completely backgrounded.
Well, that's the other concern. I was just going to ask Lori about that. The Democrats may not have a case in terms of this somehow being a unique situation, jamming through so many nominees at once. But they do have reason to be a little concerned, probably, about the fact the vetting isn't complete on most of these people.
Well, these folks have to go through an FBI background check and also an ethics background check. And this is a little bit more complicated than prior years because a lot of these folks have not been in public office.
Yeah.
And they have such, diverse backgrounds and business backgrounds and business ties. So there is a lot of extra vetting that needs to be done. And a lot of it will not get done before these hearings happen. And that's an issue that Democrats are bringing up. And they're also, you know, what's interesting, and I think you even put this in the note, Bill, was that Tom Price is not on this list.
Yeah,
I
want to talk about that in a minute. But before we get there,
yeah.
Buddy, here's what I'm interested in. And Jim, you should weigh in on this, too. So we are likely to see some of these these nominees confirmed before all the background checks have been returned. It strikes me that if there is any dirt, major dirt, revealed by any of these checks, this is a big opening for the media once you've got confirmed cabinet officers to go after them. Now, is it going to affect Trump voters? No. But in some ways, it strikes me that you're in a worse position if you've been confirmed and then some really ugly stuff comes out about you.
I think what will happen, though, is that the hearings will be held and they will be voted out of committee. However, I think before the full Senate does a confirmation, I think the information will probably be in there.
All right.
You don't have to do it all at one time.
And I'm glad you pointed that out because, Todd, that is part of this. The committees will almost certainly approve the each of these nominees. The real fight could come on the floor where there can be extended debate on all of these folks, right?
And again, the making it hurt as much as possible.
Yeah.
But for some of these folks, for a Jeff Sessions, for a Tom Price, these guys have lived public lives for 20 and 30 years. I don't think there's a more stringent vetting process than a 6th congressional district Republican primary or than a statewide election in Alabama. And when you're talking about the generals who are nominees in the Trump administration, I don't know how much background you know on somebody who has spent the last 30 years of his life in a uniform under microscopic inspection.
Okay, well, Laura, you brought it up. You know, considering they want to jam through as many of these people as possible, considering that Tom Price is arguably, at least in the early days of the administration, going to be the single most cabinet officer as Secretary of Health Human Services, he'll be the guy to unwind Obamacare. I personally find it fascinating they didn't try to ram this through right away as well.
I did too. I mean, when I was looking at the schedule, I was surprised not to find Congressman Tom Price's name, you know, on the committee hearing, the confirmation process. And there have been questions raised about some of his investments in the healthcare industry. And while he was budget chairman and he was voting on legislation. So there are some ethical questions that Democrats are bringing up, whether they come to fruition or not. I mean, some of them are alleging that it was illegal insider trading, but they're not bringing any proof of that. So that might be something that the media will vet more hearings.
Well, let me disagree with you a little bit on that. I don't think it's unusual at all because, I mean, if you put Tom Price in front of a bipartisan Senate committee, he's going to have to answer that ticklish question that we've been talking about is what's the pace of repealing and replacing Obamacare? They have got to have at least a sketch that they can hand him and to say this is what we want to do.
That's an interesting perspective. They're going to wait on Price until he has something at least apparently
tangible.
Yeah, tangible. To talk about.
One thing about Tom Price is I can say he's been the most consistent member of the cabinet insofar as his philosophy and his actions are concerned. So you know what you're getting with Tom Price, even if you don't agree with it. But I will say that he's got to find out what his marching orders are before he goes before the Senate.
All right, it's going to be fascinating to watch that unfold. We got to take a break. Time is really flying by on this show today. It's 2:49 on Monday afternoon. When we come back to Political Rewind, a report from the front lines of the culture wars.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and, well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Buddy Darden, Todd Rehm, and Lori Geary are with us for today's show, the first of our three-day-a-week Political Rewind schedule, Monday and Wednesdays at 2, Fridays at 3. All right, so by now, if you haven't heard the actual sound, you know that last night Meryl Streep was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Hollywood Foreign Press, which I think it's fair to say used to be a sort of a disreputable organization. And suddenly, because we're so hungry for award shows on TV, they've been elevated to this position of great status. And you probably have heard, if you haven't heard her remarks, we'll play a few of them. She used her speech to talk without naming him about Donald Trump.
But there was one performance this year that stunned me. It sank its hooks in my heart, not because it was good. There was nothing good about it. But it was effective, and it did its job. It made its intended audience laugh and show their teeth. It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter.
Now the poor guy, you got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
Someone he outranked in privilege, power, and the capacity to fight back. It kind of broke my heart when I saw it, and I still can't get it out of my head because it wasn't in a movie. It was real life.
Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway responded on a couple of the morning shows. Here's some of what she said.
Let's talk about Meryl Streep, by the way. I think it's great that she wants to give a platform. But seriously speaking, why didn't she use that platform to talk about the mentally challenged boy last week who was tortured on a live streaming Facebook by four young African-American adults in Chicago screaming racial...
One of whom was done by a bunch of miscreants. The other one was done by the president-elect of the United States.
I was merely saying that when you tune into the Golden Globes award show, is it always appropriate to talk politics? They can say what they want, but then they have to be held to account. I mean, look, that's a very myopic place. That place,
that's
this
fine.
Network, frankly, all believe
but is
the election
wrong?
Would turn out a different way.
Is she wrong that it was wrong for Trump to make gestures like that about
he
a
did,
man with disabilities?
But that is not what he did, and he has said that 1,000 times, as he tweeted out
he
today.
Can say
he
it
said
a million.
100
Look
times.
At the video.
So that was Kellyanne Conway on CNN this morning. Laura Geary, the reason I think this is worth playing, taking some time on, is this really does show us the divide. The Trump supporters couldn't care less about what Meryl Streep and her friends in the glitterati in that hotel ballroom in L.A. think about Donald Trump. And in fact, it further alienates them and makes them feel as though they're not understood. I mean, this is a culture war that will continue, I suspect, throughout the entire Trump administration.
And I think you only had to look to social media. There was no gray area here. It was black and white. Either you turned on the TV to see Meryl Streep or you turned it off. And I think this is, and you know, this is what Donald Trump supporters have been saying, is like, that was done with how many months ago? He addressed it. He talked about it, and here you are bringing it up again on this golden stage in front of this, you know, glowing audience. And it's what I think drives the Trump supporters even more, like
yeah.
you said.
Yeah, three words, Hollywood, foreign, and press.
Yeah. Well, even Meryl Streep said that
you
last night.
You could have stopped at Hollywood.
Yeah, but I will tell you what, Bill, if that clip that we played, that was Andrew Cuomo on CNN, and if you had extended that clip just a little bit, you heard Kellyanne Conway say something very, very interesting, and that was, do we pay attention to what passes across Donald Trump's lips, or do we pay attention to what's in his heart?
Everybody's a producer, Jim.
But that's just
I agree. I'm kidding you.
Think about that.
Yeah, you're right.
Jim, I love Meryl Streep. I've watched most of her movies, and I was watching last night when she made that statement, and I turned to my wife, Lillian, and said, I see a tweet coming any minute now, because why he can't just ignore these people and move on, but what he does by responding like that, and Laurie, you and Todd, y'all are in the political business. You understand this business better than I. But what you do when you respond like he does, then, of course, you help fuel the fire more and more. So I suggest to you that he's just got to turn his tweeter off. And life goes on.
Well, that's not going to happen. Todd, Trump said she was an overrated actor. That's hard to take.
The great irony of all of this is that Donald Trump is 100% the creation of first tabloid journalism in New York City, and then its heir, which is reality television.
Yeah.
Without those two, he was never a political player at the presidential level.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure this is only the first of many times.
And you say that Republicans or Trump supporters don't care about this. They care wildly about it because they love getting angry at what some
liberal said. Oh, no, I understand. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Correct. And the greatest power that any of us who disagree with Meryl Streep or Donald Trump has is to simply ignore them for a while.
All right. We're almost out of time. I told you at the start of the show, or in the middle of the show, that Todd, we have a historic date today that Lisa Clark found for us. It was on January 9th, 1961, that Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes arrived at the University of Georgia, the first African-Americans to be admitted at UGA.
That was in my morning email well at about 7:30.
Oh, good.
I
thought we were going to have Stump the Chump.
But then we're on the same page. But here's another thing that made me think about this today. Tom Johnson, the great Los Angeles Times newspaper publisher, the great president of CNN, the close aide to Lyndon B. Johnson in the White House, was in our studios, the Two-Way Street studios, a couple weeks back to do a profile with us. And he was at UGA as a student, an editor at the Red and the Black, and also writing for the Macon Telegraph when this happened. And here's just a little excerpt from our interview with Tom.
I think the first night I was in front of her dorm as I saw a fellow student, some sort of out of the crowd with what was a brick to throw through her dorm window. I was there when one of the women who was in the dorm was quoted by a fellow student of having said to Charlene, "Honey, we really are so glad you're here. We really needed a maid to clean up these halls." But I must tell you, it was a defining moment in my life because I really hadn't experienced it in Macon. Seeing the inhumanity almost of the way in which people were treating her.
Tom Johnson talking about covering the acceptance of Hamilton Holmes and Charlene Hunter. By the way, he then invited Charlene Hunter to join the staff of the Red and the Black, and she didn't stay because there was so much anger about her. Do you remember that well, buddy? We got about 30 seconds for you to say something about it.
I was not at Georgia at the time, but I've come to know Charlene and also the late Hamilton Holmes. Yeah. And they were wonderful people, and they've made great contributions to Georgia and society.
Well, we have been working, the entire team at Two-Way Street, our other show here, on editing this really remarkable conversation with Tom Johnson. He has so many phenomenal stories to tell that we are trying to compact it in an hour or so, and we're working on that. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to air it on Two-Way Street. But in the meantime, this is Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, we really appreciate your joining us from far off Cobb County. Hope you get out of your driveway to come do Lawmakers tonight. Todd Rehm, always great to have you here. Lori Geary, thank you. And Buddy Darden, you as well. Lisa Clark, Jenny Amond, and our intern, Robert Jimison, thanks for all you do to get this show on the air. I'm Bill Nygut. We will see you back here on Wednesday at 2 o'clock when we'll report on the governor's state of the state and, I hope, Donald Trump's news conference.